Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening. Wherever you get your podcast, rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, your man Baker Mayfield. It's going to be an interesting season watching him and the Browns. We'll talk about that, the NBA All-Decade teams. And by the way, some of you guys telling us why you quit football. But first, all right, I got to start this here block of the podcast with all the prefacing and stuff like that, right? And I got to start this prefacing because y'all kind of messy. All right, I am going in the course of this podcast to make some broad statements about the state of the sports media industry. It just so happens that I work for the incumbent entity in the sports media industry and one, by the way, that y'all look to find a lot of drama surrounding, right? I'm going to go ahead and nip that in the bud for you right now. What I'm going to talk about in this segment is about the sports media industry. Some of it may apply to my employers, but this is not at all any sort of direct attack or anything as such toward the people for whom I work, right? No matter what our differences of agreement, no matter what our differences of opinion might be on some of these matters, I ain't just getting on the microphone laying waste to them. But there's some larger points to be made at the intersection of sports and real life, and here I am to talk about them. And I have to say, I did not expect that the intersection of sport and real life would so readily come at the Hall of Fame ceremony. Now, I want to run this one by you right fast, just tell you, like, give it to you how I took all this in. So Thursday came, and it was the Hall of Fame game. I ain't really much out here for the fake football games. I mean, I'm not really for it. I admit I did wind up watching like a couple minutes of the fake football, and I looked up, and it was Matt Schaub on one side, and I've already forgotten who was playing quarterback for the Denver Broncos at that point. I guess it was Drew Locke because it wasn't Joe Flacco. Like, I was just, come on, man, what are we doing here? You know, don't nobody feel like engaging in this? But the only reason that I turned to it was somebody hit me and was like, yo, Ed Reed just showed up on the field before the game with a T-shirt with the faces of black victims of police brutality. And I was like, oh, tell me more. All right. So after I see that, I ran a search on Twitter and fairly consistently ran a search on Twitter that night for Ed Reed's shirt, because I wanted to see what the discussion was that surrounded the shirt that he wore. Now, of course, the search Ed Reed shirt is not going to capture everything that everybody has to say about the matter, but it was kind of tumbleweeds on that search. There was not very much attention paid to it, which I find to be extra odd considering everybody that came out there was wearing the fancy polo shirt that the Hall of Fame had issued them, except for Ed Reed, who showed up in a T-shirt. Ed Reed even did his interview with Michelle Tafoya in the T-shirt. Now, let me tell you what was funny about that for me as it came to NBC. If you look at the way that they did that camera shot when he was walking on the field, they locked that thing in tight. They were trying at all costs not to put his T-shirt on the camera. But when he did the interview with Michelle Tafoya, you can't really do that because you're trying to get both of them in the shot. And while Ed Reed isn't the biggest dude in the world, Michelle Tafoya isn't the tallest. So in order to get them both in the shot, you kind of had to have Ed's shirt there. Now, of course, they wasn't asking him no questions about that shirt or anything like that. But it seemed very clear to me that that broadcast was trying to do what it could to not talk about what was on that shirt. Now, I want to be fair also, though, to the people at NBC on this level. Colin Kaepernick did his thing where he did not stand for the national anthem. It took 2 weeks before anybody noticed. And by the way, the post game on both of those, nobody asked him any questions about it. And as I recall, on the fateful one where everything jumped off, he came there to the press conference with a T-shirt with Castro and Malcolm X on it. Ain't nobody asked him about that neither. I bring that up simply to say, I'm not convinced that everybody who would be involved in the decisions about what to do if you recognize what Ed Reed's shirt was signifying necessarily knew what Ed Reed's shirt was signifying, right? I am not discounting the possibility that people were totally oblivious except for the fact that they zoomed that thing in tight on his face, not to put that out there, okay? it struck me when I saw that in that moment, because it seemed that the approach that is now being taken, if people try to use the platform they have via sports to bring attention to something else, basically they treat them like trolls. They treat them like streakers, right? Like, yeah, just don't put it on camera, right? Don't give them attention. Attention is all they want, right? Don't give that any oxygen. Then it's going to turn into a fire, right? That seems to be the approach that they have decided to take on these matters. And, like, I mean, I think we'd all have to acknowledge that's a bit problematic. Like, Ed Reed is not a troll. His men who are trying to bring these points before you are not trolls. But that is the way they are being treated, because their message is being treated as one that is trollish rather than truly being treated as one that comes from a place of sincerity, or comes from a place of humanity, or comes from a place that is acknowledging that there's some things that we need to work on collectively. And that bothers me. And the more I think about the way that this industry in general is handling these matters, we only view them through the lens of what makes white people mad. Like, that's it. Like, whatever the import of the message is, that goes completely out the window because some white people get mad. Not even all the white people. It is the presumption that some white people are getting mad. And what, as an industry, we have decided is that we are offering up these sports. And don't worry, white folks, we ain't going to try to make y'all mad. And you, I mean, that's whack, man. Like that, like, to me, and the way that feels and the way that hits, given like how important some of these matters are, that's so insulting. It is so patronizing. And it's not just patronizing to like Ed Reed or whoever want to do something like him. It's patronizing to you, the viewer. It's patronizing to you, the consumer. They are hitting you with this idea that basically you are unable to handle this, that you cannot take this. And so many of y'all are like, yeah, you're right, we can't. Like, I myself personally, I'd be a little bit insulted if somebody was telling me that I could not handle messages of black humanity. A lot of y'all out here are cool with that. Okay, I mean, I guess this is how you get down. But I wanted to start with that idea and that point that Ed Reed on Thursday was being treated like a troll, and then fast forward to Champ Bailey. Now, in between Ed Reed on Thursday and Champ Bailey on Saturday, there was an Ed Reed speech on Thursday that I found to be meandering. I thought had parts that I vehemently disagreed with, most notably his thing, don't do nothing to make the police do something that they don't want to do, as if people who getting shot by the cops are making somebody do it to them. Like, yo, Ed, pick up a newspaper, read some of them stories. I imagine there are certainly some that fit the description of what you provided, but that ain't the ones that people are really that worried about. You know what I mean? Like, that's not the one that really gets people up in arms, is the idea that you started a fight with a cop and got smoked. There's arguments to be made that that ain't that cool either, but those aren't really the ones that get people out here in these streets. But anyway, Champ Bailey gave his speech, and I found it to be interesting because I don't, like, recall ever hearing Champ Bailey talk before. By the way, Gabe, you are a mere 28 years old. Do you understand what a monster Champ Bailey was?
Yes, I do.
Woo, boy. Champ Bailey in college, I don't know if you heard that, but he said it in his speech, where he was like, yo, I went to Georgia, and they told me I could do it. Or maybe it was on the wiki, I can't remember which. But they told him, I could do whatever I want when I went to Georgia. And what I did was I did whatever I wanted. He played quarterback. He played wide receiver. He played running back. He played corner. He was a monster at all of these things. Like, he was an incredible player, but I don't ever recall really hearing him talk about anything. And I imagine part of that probably has to do with playing so much of that time in Denver, and I wasn't really, like, keeping up with the media reports out of Denver. But he was probably the quietest great corner that we could think of that era, and a great corner he absolutely was. Like, there's an argument that Champ Bailey was a better corner than Deion Sanders. You can make that argument. I'm not sure I'm doing it, but you can. But so for me, I never really heard his voice, and I heard his speech, and I thought his speech was pretty good, and it went through a lot of interesting places and the twists and turns in his career, and then he closed that thing with a hammer right here.
I'm a firm believer that if you want to create change, you better start with your friends and your family. So I'm starting here today. The first thing people see when they look at me is not a Pro Football Hall of Famer or a husband or a father. They view me first as a black man. So on behalf of all the black men that I've mentioned tonight and many more out there, who've had the most of the same experience I've had in my lifetime, we say this to all of our white friends. When we tell you about our fears, please listen. When we tell you we're afraid for our kids, please listen. When we tell you there are many challenges we face because of the color of our skin, please listen. And please do not get caught up in how the message is delivered.
That man's up there. You know what it probably takes for a dude like Champ Bailey to stand in front of a room full of people and talk about what he's afraid of? Like, to talk about fear and vulnerability in such a way? Like, that was as profoundly human a moment as I can recall at the Hall of Fame that didn't get awkward. Cats got a tendency to get up there and start talking about their family stuff. And you're like, yo, can we talk about something else? Yeah, your mama really went through it, but you ain't got to put in all them details. But anyway, what was interesting about that Champ speech was the NFL put that out on its social channels with the quote, please listen, excerpted, and then sent that out. Like, that was on the NFL brand name. They took his message and they're like, nah, man, this is something that America needs to hear. And they put that out there. And that tells me that somehow the NFL has demonstrated itself to be more comfortable with some of these things than the people that cover the NFL. Or maybe it's possible that with the media landscape being what it is right now, the NFL can afford to put their name on something like that because the rest of us are not really going to amplify it. And so they can get the points for being down for it. And then the people that normally do their bidding for them in terms of getting information out, they just won't put it out. Maybe that's what it is. I don't know. But I do feel like if you need to look up and the NFL is being like, yo, maybe y'all could loosen up a little bit. Look what happened and everything was okay. Maybe everybody else needs to loosen up just a little bit. I mean, it's a thought. I think it's something that's absolutely worth considering because it ain't like Champ Bailey said that and started getting booed. I don't recall anything indicating that when Ed Reed came out there with that shirt on that anybody booed him or anything like that. Like, yo, man, maybe, just maybe, it is quite possible that the folks out here can handle a little more reality than people are giving them credit for being able to handle. Or maybe, this is a fascinating illustration of just how much we revere champions and Hall of Famers. All right. So one thing about Champ in giving that speech, and same with Ed Reed, though, again, his was all over the place. One thing about it that is interesting to me, at least, is we've made the decision like, hey, if you achieve this height in your career, then we're going to give you the microphone. Take all the time you want. Say all the stuff you want to say. It is your world. You got it right here. Ain't nobody cutting off the microphone on you while you giving your Hall of Fame speech. Like, maybe that's part of it too, right? Like I imagine there's somebody involved that would have loved to have cut the microphone when those things went in those directions. Gay, can you imagine what a thing it would have been if Champ Bailey was given that and then they cut the microphone off on him?
Yeah, it's not like the Oscars. There's no music and person standing on the stage to usher you off with your trophy.
Right, no. Everybody would know exactly what time it was if you cut the microphone off. Everybody would know what time it was. So what you got to do is you got to ride this out, right? And you know why you got to ride this out? Because we have decided that you, as Hall of Famer, you get to say whatever you want in this moment. This is yours. And so whatever their message happened to be, and by the way, Champ's message wasn't anything close to being incendiary, but they were going to let him get it out, all right? This was going to be it. Like, this is the ultimate, I got the mic and you can't do nothing about it sort of situation. And he took it. And I think that most people probably should have been better off for it. I think they also, and I hadn't really talked too much anywhere about the actual message itself. The message itself is very interesting where he's like, hey, man, listen to your friends when your friends tell you these things. I would add something that's kind of supplementary to that, which is ask yourself whether or not these people are really your friends if you weren't listening to them in the first place. Like, what are they to you if someone had to tell you to listen when they talk about their fears and when they talk about the things that worry them? what were those people to you in the first place? Like, I think that's the level of introspection that people need to take from that, is that if you had somebody that you thought was your friend and they're trying to tell you how this stuff make them feel and your inclination is to dismiss it, is that really your friend? And if that's not really your friend, what is stopping that person from being your friend in spite of the fact that you thought that that was your friend? Like, it's a really profound sort of way to look at it and puts it in very simple terms and strategically. And I don't know how much he thought about this himself. Champ did it in a way that didn't put it in the terms of racism, because once you put it in the terms of racism, white folks got a tendency to get defensive about that, where it's like, hey, man, I didn't do this. I didn't make the world the way it was. Like, this can come up very quickly in these conversations. Please don't get mad at me if you feel like I'm generalizing. I don't know if you know this, but I've had a lot of these conversations in my life. I got a pretty good handle on how it is that they go. Right. I ain't just out here guessing. The problem with generalization is not the general, is not the simple act of generalizing, but it is typically about generalizing about things that you don't know anything about. I know a lot about this. Right. And this is how it can go. So ask yourself, why would you be inclined to dismiss your friend? Why haven't you? And look, I've had white friends who told me about this, man. They've been like, yo, I thought a lot of the stuff people were talking about was nonsense until I actually hung out with you and actually saw these things. And they're like, oh, snap, wow, man, white folks be out here tripping sometimes. Yes, 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 from time to time. It happens. It does. But people can handle this, man. I feel like they can. I think in some ways they've demonstrated they can. And I'd also say on another level, some people can handle being mad, too. They're going to be mad for a little bit. But some people can handle that. But I also think that a lot of people being mad or not mad has to do with how we frame and how we handle these things. So let's go back to what I said before about Ed Reed, where I said I felt like, you know, like the idea that people are being treated like trolls when they're trying to make these points. In retrospect, I think that all of us could stand to go look back at the ways that media outlets covered the situation with Kaepernick and ask ourselves how sincere in the macro sense we were about discussing the topic. Like, how many of us were discussing the topic because we actually had some points to make and had some good things to say and were wishing to bring the appropriate context to the matter? Or how many people were covering it because they knew it would be something that would generate some measure of ratings, and they figured out that the way to generate the ratings on it was to approach it in a way that was going to make clear sides that people could argue with? Because that's what we do when we talk about the actual sports topics, is we try to find sides for everybody to get on to argue about. Like, I think it's something to be said about us looking back at that and being like, yo, were we in some ways unnecessarily inflammatory in the way that the topic was handled? And I don't know the answer to that, by the way. I'm not saying that's necessarily true. And when I say we, I'm talking about the industry in a very large, like, macro sort of sense. And I mean, like, which is to say, like, I know myself personally, I was not out here just trying to make people mad. I think you can go back and look at anything I've ever said about the matter. It wasn't really my approach. Some people got mad, but I understand, you know, omelets, eggs, break, happens. But if you don't actually care about the issue at hand, but you found it necessary to cover what was going on around Kaepernick, it would be very easy for you to wind up being a person who presented the situation in a way that is in line with trolling, because you don't care. So if you don't care, you're going to do what you generally do, which is try to generate discussion. But what's the discussion that you generate? What's the discussion you're trying to get? You're trying to get this thing hot. You know, we're trying to get engagement. We're trying to get people on this. And sometimes the more human and subtle expressions on these things are not the things that get the engagement. They're not the ones that do it. But I feel like we could look at what happened with the Hall of Fame and, you know, with Champ Bailey and even Ed Reed, whose speech I didn't agree with in a lot of parts, right? But even that didn't send people flipping out, the people who disagree with him. But we can do this, man, right? We all believe, all of us, no matter what anybody says about, you know, look, I think this is one thing we all across the board believe. We all believe that sports can be used as a venue to do good in the world beyond simply the games that are played. We all believe that sports can be used as a vehicle to bring awareness to larger causes, right? That's in part why you see so much of this stuff with the military there, because people believe that sports is a good way to bring that particular message of patriotism to folks. That's believing in the power of sport to do good. The work that many entities in sports, including the one that I work for, puts in toward cancer awareness. We believe that we can use sports to bring this message and talk about this cause in front of people and thereby do good for the world. That is why we do this. We can make the world better by highlighting legitimate messages of humanity and what I would consider to be unity, because what Chan Bailey is talking about is unity. We can do that here. We can. We just as a collective have to ask ourselves, are we really that concerned with doing good if we only want to do good that doesn't hurt anybody's feelings? That is something that everybody listening to this needs to ask themselves, is that if you really care about doing something better, if the only time you're trying to do something better is if it doesn't offend anybody. Because I'm telling you now, if that's the case, then you do not believe that sports can actually be used to do any good on matters of race. I believe that they can. And most of us have said for a very long time that we believe that they can. Hell, one of the underrated things about Ed Reed, did you see those white folks that were there in the Ed Reed section? And like how sincerely choked up and happy they were about him and the way he talked about them and the way they talked about him. Like they were like, you know, every perception you got about racist Louisiana, man, them people looking at each other like family. And those things can happen, right? Like these are possible. That's not like, oh, look how great the world is because of these two people. But in a micro example, man, thinking about some of the obstacles that we got to overcome just to talk to each other, that's pretty damn significant, right? We all believe that sports can do good on this particular matter. But if we only gonna do it if it don't make nobody mad, then at some point sports is actually going to become part of the problem. And I myself personally would rather it be somewhat part of a solution. Are you ready for football, Gabe? It's almost there.
As ready as I'll ever be.
Well, let me ask this. I was going to ask if you're ready for football, but I wanted you to answer that as a sports fan, not as a producer of content, because as a producer of content, I would like it to get here right now.
There are definitely two competing views there. I'm going to be interested to see how this season turns out. We got a lot of incendiary things going on around the league.
Yeah, no, the league is, I mean, I do think we have some like pretty, as much as we talk about like, you know, the NBA has had all these interesting stories for the last couple of years. But I think the NFL for the first time that I can really think of has like a lot that I think are interesting right now. Like I think what's going on right now with the Cowboys is very interesting. I think the Chiefs just in terms of watching their offense is interesting. But of course, it's like year two of Pat Mahomes. I think that's a very interesting story. Bruce Arians going to Tampa. I think that one is going to be a very interesting one. What in the world happens with Lamar Jackson and whatever offense it is they're going to try to run down there? I think that one's interesting. I can go around. I missed a few. New coach with Aaron Rodgers. I think that one is a very interesting one. Everything with the Raiders, I think, is pretty interesting. Like, I mean, I really do think we got a lot here. And then we have Cleveland that went from being the Browns to being the favorites in the AFC North, basically with no stops in between, largely based on excitement generated by two dudes who really ain't done nothing. Right? Those two dudes are Baker Mayfield and Freddie Kitchens. Now, Odell Beckham, of course, is on this list of things, but I want to talk about kind of these two dudes first. Part of the intrigue with them is that neither of them truly looks the part. Freddie Kitchens absolutely does not look the part of an NFL head coach. You never heard anybody talk about him being an NFL head coach, really, until he became an NFL head coach. And then you got Mayfield, who's A, not very tall, and B, not as diplomatic, shall we say, as quarterbacks typically are. He is much more a chip on my shoulder kind of dude, but neither of them really look the part, but I also think that they kind of perfectly fit the city that they play in, because if Cleveland's got anything, God knows it's a chip on its shoulder. You know, and then Freddie Kitchens, He kind of every man, right? Nobody's kind of giving. He's kind of giving every man.
Kind of looks like every man.
Yeah. I'd say of all the people in the NFL that look like that, I mean, that make over $1 million, he looks the least like it. That's probably the way I say. You know what Freddie Kitchens look like? Freddie Kitchens look like he got this new contract and he ain't even think once about buying a new pair of shoes. I tell you what he did. He put an add on to his house. Put a new deck back there.
New bathroom or something.
Got him. And you know what? I wouldn't be surprised if he got also, what you call it? You know about the green egg?
I have seen one of those.
Does he not strike you as the sort of dude that would be really excited about getting a new green egg?
He is exactly the type of guy.
Yeah, he went out there, he got him a new grill. Like, that's what they did. That's what country folk do when you come with some money. You put something new on the house and you get you a new grill. Maybe even a new grill on the truck. You think he drive a truck?
Most definitely drives a truck.
I can see him driving a truck. See, it's hard for me to gauge that though, because I'm from Texas where everybody has a truck basically. And so I don't know, like, for the rest of the South, just exactly what the distribution of pickup trucks to the male population is. But I know in Texas, oh yeah, that man absolutely, has a truck. Transition lenses. Can you see those?
I haven't seen one with glasses though.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. So he might not be that dude. But yeah, that's the kind of everyman vibe that Freddie Kitchens is giving off. Like, that's that dude. But man, I'm asking everybody involved in this, man, as we do this, can y'all make me not hate the Browns? Because I don't have any reason to hate the Browns, and I don't want to hate the Browns, but I feel like y'all ain't going to be able to help yourselves in some of the ways that y'all talk about the Browns, and it's going to make it very difficult for me to like the Browns. Because I'm looking at Baker Mayfield right now, and it's not his fault that everybody is like all over some of these things that he's doing that other people probably could not get away with. However, y'all going to make me hate him if y'all don't watch out, right? Because here's one thing about Mayfield, and I'll give Mayfield this. I don't think Mayfield really cares if we like him. Like, I just don't think that's his concern. And I respect that, and that's cool. And if is that your concern, if you're not that concerned, if people like you, then you can't be concerned if somebody, like, happens not to like you. I am going to tell you guys, you need to understand this. That chip on my shoulder stuff is going to get exhausting for y'all. Because the thing about Mayfield is that chip ain't never, ever going to go away. Gabe, do you have any, like, chip on shoulder friends?
I don't. I mean, growing up in Napa, California, there's not a lot of...
Yeah, not a lot of chips.
Yeah, not a lot of chips. not a lot of difficulties.
Yeah, but people. You got short people up there.
Yeah. I mean, being a short person myself, I have had to fight my whole life. But not fighting in the same way that many others have.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
I always forget that you're short. I told you, it's the greatest compliment I can pay you.
I appreciate that every time you say it.
You carry yourself with a dignity befitting a man above average height. That's good. A lot of people struggle with that, but not you. You know who you are.
What about Baker?
That's what I don't understand, man. He ain't at that place yet. In fact, Baker Mayfield might actually be taller than I realize. Like, Baker might have that attitude, and little did we know, he's actually like 6'4". He just acting like he's 5'11". Though I think he's 6 feet. I think he's right there. At the 6 feet line. You know what I also kind of figured out? Like, actual fast short dudes, they don't seem to have it. Like, Kyler Murray doesn't seem to have it, but that's because he's really fast. I don't know. It's a hypothesis. But anyway, like, I saw Baker sitting there with the, chugging the beer in the suite. You saw that? Where he bit the can open with his mouth and chugged the beer, and he was sitting there with a mustache.
I did see that, and he looked like an average guy at the game as opposed to an NFL quarterback.
Yes, he did. Now, part of it for me was, and again, this is not Baker Mayfield's fault, but it must be nice to be able to get away with doing something like that. Like, not everybody could pull this off, and people would just be like, oh, wow, this is so cool and charming. Cam Newton do something like that, they're going to be like, so who's driving him home? How's he going to get back? That could be wildly irresponsible. But again, it's not Baker Mayfield's fault. But we're going to wind up in a situation where he's a dude that winds up getting praised a lot for things that people get criticized for on some other sides. And that can be kind of hard for me to watch. It can. It can be a little difficult. I think we're going to have a tendency to do a measure of overrating here, because all of this is like, it's new and it's exciting. And he's got an obvious charisma and cool to him. And he is a good player. He is a talented player. Like, this could be really cool with the Browns. But I just feel like we all going overboard with it already because they are in fact still the Cleveland Browns. Like, I really just want to see how this goes. You know who the Browns are the worst for, though, right? Mike Tomlin. The thing with Tomlin is, Tomlin's out here living in the era of Belichick, and his record against Belichick is so bad. Like, how much different are things for the Steelers if they're just not up there losing to the Patriots all the time? And it is not. I mean, it is a bit of an indictment on Tomlin that he never seems to figure out how to get past whatever it is that Belichick has come up with. But, man, if it's one thing to be out here losing to Belichick, man. They go out there and lose to Freddie Kitchens? Yeesh. And didn't this is the team that does not have Antonio Brown anymore?
Yeesh.
Ben Roethlisberger getting a little older?
Yeesh. It's a lot of yeesh
going on there for them if they finish behind the Cleveland Browns. Invariably, you would think something is going to go wrong because they are, in fact, the Browns. But they've got great players. Like, I think we could fairly say, well, it's too early to say Mayfield is great, but Mayfield could be great. But they have a very good, promising quarterback. They have a great wide receiver. They have a great edge rusher. Like, you know, these are good things to start with. But they also got a coach that's already out here talking about anybody who's an anonymous source is going to get fired. Ooh, you don't sound insecure at all there, Freddie. Oh, no, not even a little bit. So you got a coach that hadn't done this before. By the way, working for a franchise that fires coaches immediately after they have come up short of expectations. And that's even when the expectations weren't high in the first place. They get dudes up out of there fast. Freddie Kitchens is the only coach I can think of ever that's on the hot seat before the job starts because people think they're going to win the damn division. So we got that. We got Mayfield, and, you know, he was hollering at the receivers the other day, and Odell said, hey, if that's the way that Baker wants to do it, this is the way we're going to do it. And that's how it goes at first. How you think that's going to go down the line? How you think that's going to go if Baker is not hitting Odell when Odell is open? How's it going to go? I don't care how cool Odell and Jarvis Landry are. They still wide receivers. How's it going to go? It don't matter if Odell's the one that's always open or Jarvis Landry doesn't feel like he's getting the ball enough. How you think that was going to ride out? Like, there's a lot here that can happen in Cleveland. It could be very good. It could be very bad. I also realized that by the end of this segment, I completely forgot what I was going to talk about at the beginning of it and then talked about a bunch of other stuff, but I think it was fascinating. Either way it goes, I don't think I'm going to hate the Browns, and hopefully Baker Mayfield won't get on my nerves with all this everybody hates me. It's not even everybody hates me. That's an inappropriate way to put it, but you understand what I'm saying. You got a chip. As Gabe, if you had any chip people around you, them chip dudes, they get exhausted, man. They get exhausted. You know part of why they get exhausted? You stay having to fight. You're like, nah, man, I can't go to the club with you. No, we can't go to the club this week. No, because somebody's going to accidentally step on your shoes and you don't think they're going to say sorry fast enough. And now we all got to fight because you got that chip. We don't need chip. Chip got hard to deal with. But could make for a very entertaining 16-game NFL season. All right, we'll be back to talk about the NBA All-Decade Team in a minute. But first, after hearing me talk about ButcherBox for months, if you haven't taken advantage of their amazing offers, you need to listen up. Every month, ButcherBox delivers humanely raised 100% grass-fed beef, free-range, organic chicken, heritage breed pork, and wild-caught Alaskan salmon directly to your door. Choose from 4 curated boxes or customize your own box with all of your favorite cuts. And with free shipping, ButcherBox makes getting high-quality meat with no added hormones or antibiotics easier than ever. The last box I got came with some bacon, some ground beef, and some ribeye steaks. The ribeye was probably the best. Just threw it up on the grill on the roof and loved every bite, loved every minute of the experience. And if my method isn't for you, ButcherBox has a ton of awesome recipes and resources on their website that'll help you bring out all the flavor of each cut of meat you get from ButcherBox. And this month, ButcherBox is offering new members $20 off your first box, plus 2 pounds of ground beef and 2 packs of bacon when you sign up at ButcherBox.com/Bomani. That's right. In addition to all the great meat you get, ButcherBox is knocking $20 off your first box and throwing in an additional 2 pounds of ground beef and 2 packs of bacon when you sign up at ButcherBox.com/Bomani. ButcherBox.com/Bomani. All right, the NBA did an all-decade team for 2010. Hey, have they ever done this before?
I haven't seen one, but although this isn't like quite official from the NBA, it's just from NBA.com.
Oh, that's all it is. Okay, because yes. I was curious about that because I'd never seen it. So you guys haven't seen it. The NFL's done all-decade teams forever. Here is the first team all, what are we calling that decade? Is it the teens?
I guess so. 2010s.
All right. So here we go. Steph Curry, James Harden, LeBron James, Kevin Durant, and Kawhi Leonard. Second team, Chris Paul, Russell Westbrook, Anthony Davis, Blake Griffin, Carmelo Anthony. Third team, Dwayne Wade, Kobe Bryant, Paul George, LaMarcus Aldridge, Giannis, Antetokounmpo. Dave, you know people think I'm a Kobe hater, right?
I do. I do know that.
I don't hate Kobe. Shannon hates Kobe. I'm just honest about Kobe and his career. Are you a little surprised that Kobe snuck into the third team when he hadn't had a good season since 2013?
Yeah, that felt more like an homage vote than anything else.
Yeah, like, I mean, I feel like Kemba Walker has room to be upset about this. And I never thought I'd be in a situation where I say something about how Kemba Walker has room to be upset that he's ranked below Kobe Bryant on something. I felt like that was a little low for him. At first, I thought it was a little high for James Harden, but then I thought about it. No, he's been doing this for that long. Like, I feel like that's what this list made me realize is, yo, man, we're getting a little bit old. Like Kawhi Leonard. Now, granted, Kawhi Leonard has been on the All-Star team only 3 times and made All-NBA 3 times. But Kawhi Leonard also has, what, 2 championships and 2 finals MVPs and a Defensive Player of the Year award. Like, yeah, that'll throw you – that'll get you on the first team all decade. But it really made me look up and be like, yo, like with the Warriors, for example. The Warriors didn't become like the Warriors until 2014, 2015. But Steph had been an All-Star before that. Like, he's been doing this now 7, 8 years. Chris Paul, I mean, he's been doing this forever. Anthony Davis, like, yo, Anthony Davis played basically that whole decade. Blake Griffin played that whole decade. Gabe, all my favorite players are old now.
There is a turnover that's happening with the league right before our eyes.
Yeah, like Paul George. Paul George going into his 10th season now. Like, yeah, he kind of belongs on something like this. You realize LaMarcus Aldridge has been in the league for 13 years? By the way, what's this disrespect to D-Wade? D-Wade got a couple championships. D-Wade would have been finals MVP if LeBron didn't let him down in 2011. D-Wade made the third team, like, just ahead of Kobe Bryant? I feel like he got dissed. Is there an argument, by the way, for Kobe Bryant on this over Dirk Nowitzki? If we're going to talk about guys that did whatever damage they did in the early part of this, is there room for that one? And I ask you this. This is what I'm curious about. What do you think? Carmelo Anthony, second team all decade.
Yeah, his time on the downslope of his career has seemed to be a long time. But I'm just trying to remember when the last good year was that he had.
I do not have a great answer for how good I think Carmelo Anthony has been as an NBA player. I have no great answer for that. Because second team, it doesn't feel bad, but I don't know if it feels right. I don't have anybody that I can throw off the top of my head that I think is like better necessarily. But when this is all said and done with Melo, and I thought about this like Stephen A. did the interview with him last week, I don't know what I'm ultimately going to think or what we're ultimately going to think of him. And it also kind of speaks to a degree how we view guys differently if they just stay on one team. Like if Melo had the exact same career, but he stayed in Denver, do we feel better about him or do we feel worse about him? Or the same if he did it in New York? Because I don't think he gets nearly enough credit for his time in New York. I don't think he gets enough credit for like what he meant to that team. And the fact that, yo, nobody has wanted to play for the Knicks. He wanted to go and play for the Knicks. He took everything that came with playing for the Knicks. They actually had a couple of pretty decent teams while he was playing for the Knicks. But he's a guy that I feel like we're always going to evaluate in the context of what he wasn't at the expense of what he was. And he's too good for us to not appreciate what it is that he was.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, Bo, this first story comes from tech.
Hi, I'm Victoria Song. I'm a consumer tech reporter for Gizmodo, and I'm here to talk about the Sony Rion Pocket. It's basically a small wearable air conditioner that's about the size of a card wallet, and you slip it into a pocket in a special undershirt at the back of your neck, and it connects to an app. You hit a button, and then you can just basically set what temperature you'd like to be. So on a hot day, you can use it to keep yourself cool, and on a cold day, you can use it to keep yourself warm. Sony's crowdfunding it through their First Flight program, and since it launched a couple of weeks ago, it's already met 100% of its funding goal. So prices range from somewhere around $117 to somewhere closer to $175, and depending when they get funded fully, backers can expect to see their wearable HVACs sometime around March 2020. But, you know, even though it's really hot in the U.S., it's a Japan-only product, so hopefully they take some pity on us over here.
Did they say Sony is crowdfunding?
I did think the part of that story was really interesting.
Like you talking about the same Sony that makes PlayStations?
Yeah, like they need more money to work on a product. It's interesting.
Are you kidding me? Anyway, I don't know about you, Gabe, but this idea sounds great. The problem is it sounds like one of those ideas that sounds so great until you find out it gives you cancer.
Exactly. Or it malfunctions and ends up blowing up on your back.
Yes,
right?
Yeah. Suddenly your undershirt has caught on fire.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, your undershirt is perfectly dry because your pocket air conditioner has kept you so cool that you did not sweat.
And it's not just an air conditioner. The fact that it also will heat you up in the maritime, that sounds like there's more room for malfunction.
Bad news.
All right. This next story comes from retail.
This is Abha Vatrai, business reporter for The Washington Post. Banana Republic last week began selling hijabs on its website, following in the footsteps of a number of major retailers, including Macy's and Uniqlo. Nike sells a hijab for athletes, and even American Eagle briefly got into the game with a $20 denim hijab. Banana Republic says it's selling the religious head coverings to celebrate diversity, but it also makes a lot of business sense. Muslim consumers spend nearly $300 billion a year worldwide, so this is an important and growing demographic. The Muslim shoppers I talked to in the story were encouraged by the news. They said it was a step towards diversity and inclusion, and that it was particularly important now, given the political climate where there is so much vitriol towards immigrants and people of color. Some did wonder, though, if this was a way for major companies to profit off of a religious garment, and whether there was any risk of cultural appropriation of people who weren't Muslim buying hijabs and wearing them as fashion accessories. But for the most part, they said they were encouraged by Banana Republic's efforts, and that they hoped that more mainstream clothing chains would begin thinking about their needs.
You know, it's interesting that before this story, I had, just in hearing this played, I was like, wow, you know, I never thought about where you go to buy a hijab. You know, and I'd assume that there's some, you know, a store that does this or whatever, but I had never really thought about that just as an idea that there's no reason why a hijab is not something that you would be able to buy in any clothing store. You know, like there's no shortage of people who are Muslim in the United States. It's not like it shocks you when you see somebody wear any hijab. Like it's not uncommon. I hadn't really thought about it in that way. But they got to the end. When she got to the end, she got to the part that struck me about this story from the very beginning, which is, I would like to see, what do they call them, Gabe, like the decks when they got them together at Banana Republic and they were like, yo, we're going to start selling these.
That would be interesting to just to see kind of inside the scenes how they're portraying it.
Right. Like who is the target audience? Because obviously the target audience should be Muslim women, but you can't ever be sure. And I would also like to know if Banana Republic thought this all the way out, because if they had thought this all the way out, I feel like they would consider sending out the email to all the locations that I would send out to the locations that are selling these jobs, which is, hey guys, don't try to get too fancy with these mannequins.
All right, this last story comes from entertainment.
This is Steve Zeitzik with the Washington Post. Country Music Television, or CMT, has long been an also-ran on the cable dial. Perhaps for not much longer, though. Chris McCarthy, a Viacom executive who recently engineered a ratings turnaround at MTV and VH1, has been given control of CMT, given a mandate to make it more modern, more updated, or as he puts it, a little less residual. Gone from the mix are shows like Kentucky, Redneck Island, and My Big Redneck Wedding. Instead, he's focusing on series like Racing Wives, which looks at the inner lives and professional accomplishments of women in the NASCAR orbit, or Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders making the team. It's a competition show that's CMT's longest-running hit. This season, though, it will take a slightly different tack on under McCarthy take matters in a more feminist direction. This would seem like a good time for such a shift, such a move to diversity. It is, after all, the summer of Old Town Road, Lil Nas X's country rap crossover that's been a smash on the Billboard charts, recently setting a record for most weeks at number one. Not everyone, though, is likely to be happy about this change. Country music remains at the heart of a culture war. Just a few weeks ago, Blair Garner, a syndicated host, was told by his employer, Cumulus Media, he couldn't air an interview he did with Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg. Old Town Road itself was the subject of controversy, booted off the Billboard country chart back in the spring when many in the establishment rejected it. It was only after Billy Ray Cyrus, the 90s hitmaker, performed on it that it was restored. McCarthy has a long, tough climb ahead of him. It remains to be seen whether he can pull it off and whether listeners or viewers will have it.
You know, the thing that's so interesting to me about all the periphery, like cultural stuff with country music is I can't think of anything that is as successful as country music. They move a lot of units over there, man. But I can't think of anything that is as successful as country music that is so like consciously insular. Like at once it is sold for mass consumption, but it has always so narrowly defined what is what. So like I'm hearing those shows like Guntucky and all that stuff or whatever. And see, the thing to me is like I'm very familiar with the South and what goes down in the country. Yo, not everybody gets down like that. Like a lot of people who are on it, like they certainly get down like that, but like not everybody gets down like that. And we're seeing these metropolitan areas in the South that are a bit more cosmopolitan and they change, but not everybody gets down according to this narrow vision. So it's interesting to see the idea that country music television or CMT now is not, yeah, you know, I think they did the KFC thing. But like CMT wants to broaden out and I imagine that there's some measure of fear that a company like that would have that their viewers are going to tune out. And I'm like, with a TV network, they're going to tune out maybe of some of those shows that they don't like. But, you know, they're going to tune into the ones that are their jam. They're going to keep coming back to that. Like, I don't know if those people are just sitting around watching nothing but CMT all day long. I imagine they flipping and finding stuff they like, and they'll stick with the ones they like. And then, you know, when they have the Lil Nas X show, they're not going to watch that.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bo. With the Hall of Fame game now in the rear view and football on the way, it's time to bring back an old favorite, the Why I Quit Football stories. First one comes from Fife in D.C.
What's up, Bo? This is Fife from D.C. In my mind, I think I could have made the Hall of Fame, but let me take you back. Back in my younger days, let me tell you, I'm built kind of like you, tall, thin. I'm about 6'5", maybe 210. I figure, hey, man, it was around the time of Randy Moss. Let me go out there in that football field, bless them with these Randy Moss talents. I go out, we'll go out for a receiver. I run a few routes. I come across the middle a couple of times, the linebackers. Just give me a little tap. I wish I could say they blew me up, but they didn't. They just gave me a little tap. Let me know I'm there. Let me know that they there. I ain't like that too much. Coach said, all right. Just get your Moss on. Just run a nine route. Run a nine route. That's a fly route straight down the sidelines. Just get them. So I ran the stop and go, caught the DB flat-footed. I was striding. It felt good going down the sideline. I don't know if you ever went out for a pass before, but at a certain point, you realize, oh, I'm going to need to kick another gear to get to this ball. So I did all systems check, kicked in that another gear. As soon as I made that burst to try to catch up with this bomb, felt like somebody stabbed me in the back of my leg with a hot dagger. The burning sensation was incredible. So I said, damn the pass, damn the football, and damn this sport. Woke up the next morning, black and blue, hamstring bruise. Hamstring is destroyed, and that was the end of my Hall of Fame football career.
Let me tell you something, man. That dude ain't no gangster like my mama. Ever tell you a story about my mama when she pulled a hamstring?
You did not.
So my mom, she's in her late 60s at this point. She's playing on a softball team. And my mother is like an incredibly competitive person and does not and wants to be good at whatever there is to do. And so pitch came, she swung. She got it. Like, she got in the outfield. I think she moved in and hit in the gap. And I feel comfortable saying that she hit it in the gap because she ran around first base. She rounded first. She's halfway to second. She pulls her hamstring, hits the ground, separates her shoulder. And I know that that's what's happened because my mama called me and she called my brother. I think they had given her the painkillers by then, but she called us. And I don't think I answered, but my brother did. No, she left a voicemail. She did left a voicemail. And she told what happened, but she wanted to make sure that we knew. She made it safe to second base. She hit the ground, and she crawled, and she made it to second base. Your mama is tougher than anybody else in your house, and don't you ever forget it.
I've got a short one, a good one here for you. The guy didn't leave his name, but you'll laugh at it.
What happened to me with football was that I was in the eighth grade playing for the Riviera Beach Jets, and my mom ran on the field as I got smacked on the sideline. I played quarterback. And once she ran out there with her pumps, I discovered that it was time for me to hang up my cleats.
Yo, what'd you do? Did I miss the explanation as to why she came and snatched him?
Well, he said he got knocked on the sidelines, and that caused his mom to run out on the field in her high heel.
Oh, got you. By the way, I gotta say, if he got knocked up on the sideline, his mama better be out there asking some questions. I don't know what questions, who for, or whatever, but someone would have to give me some answers.
All right, this last one comes from Isaac.
Hey, Bomani, this is Davrick Isaac. I was actually a football player, a high school and college football player. I did not quit. Played 4 years of college, small college football at Hastings College in Hastings, Nebraska. But I got to tell you a story of my father and why my father quit playing football. My father was really fast. They plucked him from the track team and told him to come out and play football. He said, okay. So they put him at wide receiver. So they had him run a route. He ran the route. They threw the ball to him. He caught the ball. And Bois, to my understanding, my daddy got blasted, lit up. Now, boy, I got to tell you, my daddy was born in 1942. So he is playing football in like the late 50s, maybe 1960. So this is not like where equipment and helmets and all that stuff. Matter of fact, my dad had a leather chin strap because he showed it. That's the only thing he kept from his uniform. So understand, he got blasted by a DB, bro. I believe it was a safety and practice. This is practice. Bro, they said, and my uncles confirmed this, my father got up, and I'm going to tell you exactly as they said it. They said he took all his shit off, meaning his pad. I mean, everything. Left it right there on the field. Only thing he kept was a chin strap in his hand, and he literally walked home and never came back to the football field again. Boy, I never laughed so hard when they told me that story.
I'm not mad at him. This all stops now. I'm not doing this anymore.
That was hilarious. That was the best one. Just left it all out on the field there. Literally left it all out on the field.
Y'all can have it, right? That's all it is. Y'all can have it. I have had enough. What? Why are you still here? That's his question.
As if it was Pee Wee football when they lent him the pads.
Yes.
You know?
He's like, why are any of us still doing this? I also love the fact that my man's explanation started with, I never quit. I was good. My pops, he was just fast. But ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We're going to do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassane handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Also, thanks to our sponsor, ButcherBox. Also, thanks to our If You Haven't Heard contributors. Thanks to Victoria Song of Gizmodo. Check out her story on a Bluetooth thermoelectric device that will be like an air conditioner, basically. Check that at gizmodo.com. Thanks to Abba Batarai of the Washington Post. Check out her story on Banana Republic selling e-jobs and whether or not that is inclusion or appropriation. Also, thanks to Steve Zeitchik of the Washington Post. He wrote a story about CMT trying to broaden its content. Be sure to check that one out. Also, be sure to check out the Woj Pod this week. He chats with Blazers guard CJ McCollum. Also, subscribe to The Right Time wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are a hater, and we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear. More driven.